like searching a school bus when it's not specifically listed in your warrant and it's not part of the curtilage.
Isaac nodded once. You would be correct unless there was cause.
Charlie snapped off the yellow glove. I did remove this from the house, but not intentionally.
Thank you for being forthcoming.
Isaac turned to Ava. She had a script to follow.
Ma'am, you can stay outside or you can leave, but you cannot go back into the house until we've released it. Do you understand?
Ava shook her head. Charlie said, she understands. Isaac walked across the yard and joined the men inside the house. Plastic containers were stacked by the door, evidence logs, zip ties, plastic bags. Ava stared through the bay window. The television was still on. The screen was so large that Charlie could read the scroll along the bottom. Pikeville PD source. School security footage will not be released. Security cameras. Charlie had not noticed them this morning, but now she recalled a camera at the end of every hallway. The murder spree had been captured on video. Ava asked,
What are we going to do?
Charlie suppressed her first answer. Watch your daughter get strapped to a gurney and executed. She told Ava, My father will explain everything back at his office. She took the rolled-up warrant from the woman's sweaty hand. There has to be an arraignment within 48 hours. Kelly will likely be held at the county jail, but then they'll transfer her somewhere else. There will be a lot of court appearances and plenty of opportunities to see her. None of this will happen quickly. Everything takes a long time. Charlie scanned the search warrant, which was basically a love letter from the judge allowing the cops to do whatever the hell they wanted. She asked Ava, Is this your address? Ava looked at the warrant.
Yes, ma'am. That's the street number.
Through the open front door, Charlie saw Isaac start yanking out drawers in the kitchen. Silverware clattered. Carpet was being stripped from the floor. None of them were being gentle. They lifted their feet high as they stomped around, checking for hollow sounds under the floorboards, poking at the stained tile in the ceiling. Ava grabbed Charlie's arm.
When will Kelly come home?
You'll need to talk about that with my father.
I don't see how we can afford any of this, Ava said. We ain't got no money if that's why you're here.
Rusty had never been interested in money. The state will pay for her defense. It won't be much, but I can promise you my father will work his heart out for your daughter. Ava blinked. She didn't seem to follow.
She's got chores to do.
Charlie looked into the woman's eyes. Her pupils were small, but that could be explained by the intense sunlight. Are you on something? She looked down at her feet.
No, ma'am. There was a pebble, but I kicked it away.
Charlie waited for an inappropriate smile, but the woman was being serious. Did you take some medication, or maybe you smoked a joint to take the edge off?
Oh, no, ma'am. I'm a bus driver. I can't take drugs. Children depend on me.
Charlie looked into her eyes again, this time for any sign of reason. Did my father explain what's happening to Kelly?
He said he was working for her, but I don't know.
She whispered.
My cousin says Rusty Quinn is a bad man, that he represents lowlifes and rapists and killers.
Charlie's mouth went dry. The woman did not seem to understand that Rusty Quinn was exactly the kind of man that her daughter needed.
There's Kelly.
Ava was looking at the television again. Kelly Wilson's face filled the screen. Someone had obviously leaked a school photo. Instead of the heavy goth makeup and black clothes, Kelly was wearing one of her rainbow pony t-shirts from the closet. The photo disappeared and was replaced with live footage of Rusty leaving the Derrick County Hospital. He scowled at the reporter who shoved a microphone in his face, but he had left by the front doors for a reason. Rusty made a visible show of reluctantly stopping for the interview. Charlie could tell by the way his mouth was moving that he was offering a cavalcade of southerny sound bites that would be played on a virtual loop by the national stations. This was how these high-profile cases worked. Rusty had to get out in front of the talking heads to paint Kelly Wilson as a troubled teenager facing the ultimate punishment, rather than as a monster who had murdered a child and her school principal. Ava whispered,
Is a revolver a weapon?
Charlie felt her stomach drop. She led Ava away from the house and stood with her in the middle of the track.
Do you have a revolver?
Ava nodded.
Eli keeps it in the glove box of the car.
The car he drove to work today. She nodded again. Does he own the gun legally?
We don't steal things, ma'am. We work for them.
I'm sorry. What I mean is your husband a convicted felon?
No, ma'am. He's an honest man.
Do you know how many bullets the gun holds?
6.
Ava sounded certain enough, but she added,
I think 6. I seen it a million times, but I never paid attention to it. I'm sorry, I can't remember.
It's all right. Charlie had felt the same way when Delia Wolford was questioning her. How many shots did you hear? What was the sequence? Was Mr. Huckabee with you? What happened to the revolver? Charlie had been right in the middle of it, but fear had dampened her recall. She asked Ava, when was the last time you saw the revolver? Ava's phone was ringing from the front pocket of her pajamas. She pulled out a cheap flip phone, the kind that let you prepay for minutes.
I don't know that number.
Charlie knew the number. It belonged to her iPhone, which Huck apparently still had. Get in the car, she told Ava, motioning for Lenore to help. Let me answer this. Ava gave Lenore a wary look.
I don't know if...
Get in the car. Charlie practically pushed the woman away. She answered the phone on the 5th ring. Hello?
Mrs. Wilson, this is Mr. Huckabee, Kelly's teacher from middle school.
How did you unlock my phone?
Huck hesitated a good long while. You need a better password than 1234.
Charlie had heard the same thing from Ben on numerous occasions. She walked up the track for more privacy. Why are you calling Ava Wilson? He hesitated a second time.
I taught Kelly for 2 years. I tutored her a few months when she moved up to the high school.
That doesn't answer the question.
I spent 4 hours answering questions from 2 assholes with the GBI and another hour answering questions at the hospital.
What assholes?
Atkins, Avery, some 10-year-old with a cowlick, and an older black chick kept tag-teaming me.
Shit, Charlie mumbled. He probably meant Lewis Avery, the FBI's North Georgia field agent. Did he give you his card?
I threw it away, Huck said. My arm's fine, by the way. Bullet went straight through.
My nose is broken and I have a concussion, Charlie told him. Why were you calling Ava? His sigh said he was humoring her.
Because I care about my students. I wanted to help, to make sure she had a lawyer, that she was being looked after by someone who wasn't going to exploit her or get her into more trouble.
Huck abruptly dropped the bravado.
Kelly's not smart, Charlotte. She's not a murderer.
You don't have to be smart to kill somebody. Actually, the opposite is usually true. She turned back to look at the Wilson house. Captain Isaac was carrying out a plastic box full of Kelly's clothes. Charlie told Huck, if you really want to help Kelly, stay away from any and all reporters. Don't go on camera. Don't let them get a good photo of you. Don't even talk to your friends about what happened, because they'll go on camera or they'll talk to reporters, and you won't be able to control what comes out of their mouths.
That's good advice.
He let out a short breath and said,
hey, I need to tell you that I'm sorry.
For?
B2, Ben Bernard, your husband called you this morning. I almost answered.
Charlie felt her cheeks flush. He said,
I didn't know until one of the cops told me. This was after I had talked to him, told him what we'd been up to, why you were at the school.
Charlie put her head in her hand. She knew how certain types of men talked about women, especially the ones they screwed in their trucks outside of bars. Huck said,
you could have warned me. It put us all in an even worse situation.
You apologize, but really it's my fault? She couldn't believe this guy. When would I have told you? Before Greg Brenner knocked me out, or after you deleted the video?
Or how about when you lied in your witness statement about how my nose got broken, which is a felony, by the way?
The lying to cover a cop's ass, not the standing around with your thumb up your ass while a woman gets punched in the face. That's perfectly legal. Huck pushed out another sigh.
You don't know what it's like running into something like that. People make mistakes.
I don't know what it's like? Charlie felt shaken by a sudden fury.
I think I was there, Huck. I think I got there before you did, so I know exactly what it's like to run into something like that. And not for nothing, but if you really grew up in Pikeville, then you know I've done it twice now, so fuck you with your you don't know what it's like.
Okay, you're right. I'm sorry. Charlie wasn't finished.
You lied about Kelly's age.
16, 17. She could picture Huck shaking his head. She's in the 11th grade. What difference does it make?
She's 18, and the difference is the death penalty.
He gasped. There was no other word for it, the sudden quick inhalation that came from absolute shock. Charlie waited for him to speak. She checked the bars on the phone.
Hello?
He cleared his throat.
I need a minute.
Charlie needed a minute, too. She was missing something big. Why had Huck been interviewed for 4 hours? The average interrogation lasted somewhere between half an hour and 2 hours. Charlie's had topped out at around 45 minutes. The entirety of her and Huck's involvement with the crime had been less than 10 minutes. Why had Delia Wolford brought in the FBI to play good cop, bad cop with Huck? He was hardly a hostile witness. He had been shot in the arm, but he'd said he was interrogated before he went to the hospital. Delia Wolford wasn't the kind of cop who didn't follow procedure. The FBI sure as shit didn't mess around. So why had they kept their star witness at the police station for 4 hours? That wasn't how you treated a witness. That was how you treated a suspect who wasn't playing ball.
Okay, I'm back, Huck said. Kelly's... what are they calling it now? Remedial? Intellectually handicapped?
She's in basic classes. She can't retain concepts. The law would call it diminished capacity, as in she's too incapable to form the mental state required for a crime, but that's a very hard argument to make, Charlie told him. There are very different priorities between a government-run school system and a government-run murder prosecution. One is trying to help her, the other is trying to kill her. He was so quiet that all she could hear was his breathing. Charlie asked, "Did the two agents, Wolford and Avery, talk with you for 4 hours straight, or was there time in between?"
"What?"
He seemed thrown by the question.
"Yeah, one of them was always in the room, and your husband sometimes. And that guy, what's his name? He wears those shiny suits."
"Ken Coyne. He's the district attorney." Charlie shifted tactics. "Was Kelly bullied?"
"Not in my classroom," he added. "Off campus, social media, we can't regulate that."
"So you're saying she was bullied?"
"I'm saying she was different, and that's never a good thing when you're a kid."
"You were Kelly's teacher. Why didn't you know that she was held back a grade?"
"I've got over 120 kids a year every year. I don't look back at their files unless they give me a reason."
"Being slow isn't a reason?"
"A lot of my kids are slow. She was a solid C student. She never got in trouble."
Charlie could hear a tapping noise, a pen hitting the edge of a table. Huck said,
"Look, Kelly's a good kid. Not smart, but sweet. She follows whatever is in front of her. She doesn't do things like today. That's not her."
"Were you intimate with her?"
"What the hell does screwing, fucking, you know what I mean?" "Of course not."
He sounded disgusted.
"She was one of my kids, Christ."
"Was anyone else having sex with her?"
"No, I would have reported it."
"Mr. Pinkman?"
"Don't even. Another student at school. How should I? What happened to the revolver?"
If she hadn't been listening for it, she would have missed the slight catch in his breath. And then he said,
"What revolver?"
Charlie shook her head, silently berating herself for missing the obvious. During her own interview with Delia Wolford, she had been too disoriented to put it together. But now Charlie could see that the woman had practically drawn her a picture.
You didn't see Mr. Huckabee hand the revolver to anyone. You didn't see him put it anywhere on his person, on the ground?
Charlie asked Huck. What did you do with it? He paused again because that's what he did when he was lying.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Is that how you answered the two agents?
I told them what I told you. I don't know. A lot was going on.
Charlie could only shake her head at his stupidity. Did Kelly say something to you in the hall?
Not that I heard.
He paused for the billionth time.
Like I said, a lot was happening.
The guy had been shot and barely grimaced. Fear had not dampened his recall. She asked, Whose side are you on?
There's no such thing as sides. There's just doing the right thing.
I hate to blow apart your philosophy, Horatio, but if there's a right thing, then there's a wrong thing. And, as someone with a law degree, I can tell you that stealing the murder weapon from a double homicide, then lying about it to an FBI agent, can land you on the wrong side of a prison cell for a hell of a long time. He kept up the silent act for 2 seconds, then said,
I don't know if we were in it, but there's a blind spot in the security cameras.
Stop talking, but if...
Shut up!
Charlie warned him. I'm a witness. I can't be your lawyer. What you tell me isn't privileged.
Charlotte, I...
She ended the call before he could dig the hole he was standing in any deeper. Chapter 5. Predictably, Rusty's old Mercedes was not parked in the lot when Lenore pulled into her space behind the building. Charlie had watched her father leave the hospital live on television. He had been half an hour from the office, roughly the same distance away as the Wilson house, so he must have taken a detour. Lenore told Ava,
Rusty's on his way.
A lie she told multiple clients multiple times a day. Ava didn't seem interested in Rusty's whereabouts. Her mouth gaped open as the security gate rolled closed behind them. The enclosed space, with its array of security lights and cameras, metal bars on the windows, and 12-foot-high razor-wired perimeter fence, looked like the staging area inside a supermax prison. Over the years, Rusty had continued to receive death threats because he continued to represent outlaw bikers, drug gangs, and child killers. Add to the list the union organizations, undocumented workers, and abortion clinics, and he had managed to piss off almost everyone in the state. Charlie's private theory was that most of the death threats came courtesy of the Culpeppers. Only a fraction came from the fine, upstanding citizens who believed Rusty Quinn served at the right hand of Satan. There was no telling what they would do when word spread that Rusty was representing a school shooter. Lenore parked her Mazda beside Charlie's Subaru. She turned around and looked at Ava Wilson.
I'll show you a place where you can freshen yourself.
Do you got a TV?
Ava asked. Charlie said, Maybe it's best not to.
I want to watch.
Charlie couldn't deny a grown woman TV privileges. She got out of the car and opened the door for Ava. The mother didn't move at first. She stared at the back of the seat in front of her, hands resting on her knees. Ava said,
This is real, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Charlie said. It is. The woman turned slowly. Her legs looked like two twigs underneath the pajama pants. Her skin was so pale as to be almost transparent in the harsh daylight. Lenore shut the driver's side door quietly, but the look on her face said she wanted to slam it off the car. She had been pissed off at Charlie from the moment she'd spotted her in the front bedroom of the Wilson house. But for Ava Wilson, she would have taken off Charlie's head and thrown it out the window on the drive back. Lenore mumbled,
This isn't finished.
Super! Charlie smiled brightly because why not pour more fuel onto the fire? There was nothing Lenore could say about Charlie's foolish actions that Charlie had not already said to herself. If there was one thing she excelled at, It was being her own inner mean girl. She handed Ava Wilson the plastic bag of clothes so she could look for her keys.
I've got it.
Lenore unlocked the steel security screen and accordioned it back. The heavy metal door required a code and another key to engage the bar lock that went straight across the inside of the door and bolted it into either side of the steel jamb. Lenore had put some muscle into turning the latch. There was a deep ka-chunk before she could open the door. Ava asked,
"Y'all keep money in here or something?"
Charlie shivered at the question. She let Lenore and Ava enter first. The familiar odor of cigarettes managed to make its way into Charlie's broken nose. She had banned Rusty from smoking in the building, but the order had come 30 years too late. He brought the stink in with him like Pigpen from the Peanuts comics. No matter how many times she cleaned or painted the walls, or even replaced the carpet, the odor lingered.
"This way."
Lenore gave Charlie another sharp look before escorting Ava to the reception area, a depressingly dark room with a metal roller shade that blocked the view to the street. Charlie headed toward her office. Her first priority was to call her father and tell him to get his ass down here. Ava Wilson shouldn't be relegated to sitting on their lumpy couch, getting all her information about her daughter from cable news. Just in case, Charlie took the long way by Rusty's office to make sure he hadn't parked in the front. The white paint on his door had bled yellow from nicotine. Stains radiated into the sheetrock and clouded the ceiling. Even the knob had a film around it. She pulled down the sleeve of her shirt to cover her hand and made sure the door was locked. He wasn't there. Charlie let out a long breath as she walked toward her office. She had purposely staked her claim on the opposite side of the building, which in its previous life had housed the back offices of a chain of stationery supply stores. The architecture of the one-story structure was similar in higgledy-piggledy-ness to the farmhouse. She shared the reception area with her father, but her practice was completely separate from his. Other lawyers came and went, renting space by the month. UGA, Georgia State, Morehouse, and Emory sporadically sent interns who needed desks and phones. Rusty's investigator, Jimmy Jack Little, had set up shop in a former supply closet. As far as Charlie could tell, Jimmy Jack used it to store his files, possibly hoping that the police would think twice before raiding an office inside a building filled with lawyers. The carpet was thicker, the decor nicer on Charlie's side. Rusty had hung a sign over her door that read, "Dewey, Pleatham, and Howe," a joke on the fact that she kept most of her clients out of the courtroom. Charlie didn't mind arguing a case, but the majority of her clients were too poor to afford a trial and too familiar with the Pikefield judges to waste their time fighting the system. Rusty, on the other hand, would argue a parking ticket in front of the United States Supreme Court if they'd let him get that far. Charlie searched her purse for her office keys. The bag slipped off her shoulder. The mouth gaped open. Kelly Wilson's yearbook had a cartoon General Lee on the front because the school mascot was the rebel. Defense counsel who possesses a physical item under circumstances implicating a client in criminal conduct should disclose the location of or should deliver that item to law enforcement authorities. It wasn't lost on Charlie that she had lectured Huck about concealing evidence while she had Kelly Wilson's yearbook tucked under her arm. Though, arguably, Charlie was caught in the legal equivalent of Schrodinger's cat. She wouldn't know if there was evidence inside the yearbook until she opened the yearbook. She looked for her keys again. The easiest thing to do was to dump the book onto Rusty's desk and let him deal with it.
"Let's go."
Lenore was back, and clearly ready to say her piece. Charlie indicated the bathroom across the hall. She couldn't do this on a full bladder. Lenore followed her inside and shut the door.
"Half of me wonders if it's even worth laying into you because you're too dumb to know how stupid you are."
"Please listen to that half." Lenore jabbed her finger at Charlie.
"Don't give me your smart mouth."
A cornucopia of smart-ass responses filled her head, but Charlie held back. She unbuttoned her jeans and sat on the toilet.
Lenore had bathed Charlie when she was too grief-stricken to take care of herself. She could watch her pee.
"You never think, Charlotte, you just do."
Lenore paced the tight room.
"You're right," Charlie said. "And I know you're right, just like I know you can't make me feel any worse than I already do."
"You're not getting out of it that easy."
"Does this look easy?"
Charlie held her arms out wide to show off the damage. "I got caught up in a war zone this morning. I antagonized a cop into making this happen." She indicated her face. "I humiliated my husband. Again. I fucked a guy who was either a martyr, a pedophile, or a psychopath. I broke down in front of you, and you don't even want to know what I was doing when the SWAT team came in. I mean, seriously, you do not want to know because you need plausible deniability."
Lenore's nostrils flared. "I saw their guns pointed at your chest, Charlotte. 6 men, all with their rifles up, all a trigger's width from murdering you while I stood outside wringing my hands like a helpless old woman."
Charlie realized that Lenore wasn't angry. She was frightened.
"What on earth were you thinking?" Lenore demanded. "Why would you risk your life like that? What was so important?"
"Nothing was that important."
Charlie's shame was amplified by the sight of the tears rolling down Lenore's face.
"I'm sorry. You're right. I shouldn't have done that. Any of it. I'm an idiot and a fool."
"You sure as hell are."
Lenore grabbed the toilet paper and rolled out enough to blow her nose.
"Please yell at me," Charlie begged. "I can't take it when you're upset."
Lenore looked away, and Charlie wanted to disappear into a pool of self-hate. How many times had she had this same discussion with Ben? The time at the grocery store that Charlie had shoved a man who'd slapped his wife. The time she'd almost got clipped by a car trying to help a stranded motorist. Antagonizing the Culpeppers when she saw them downtown. Going to the hauler during the middle of the night. Spending her days defending sleazy meth heads and violent felons. Ben claimed that Charlie would sprint headfirst into a buzzsaw if given the right set of circumstances. Lenore said,
"We can't both cry."
"I'm not crying," Charlie lied.
Lenore handed her the toilet paper roll.
"Why do you think the guy's a psychopath?"
"I can't tell you."
Charlie buttoned her jeans, then went to the sink to wash her hands.
"Do I need to worry about you going back to before?"
Charlie didn't want to think about before.
"There's a blind spot in the security cameras."
"Did Ben tell you that?"
"You know Ben and I don't talk about cases."
Charlie cleaned under her arms with a wet paper towel. "The psychopath has my phone. I need to get it turned off and replaced with a new one. I missed 2 hearings today."
"The courthouse locked down the minute the news broke about the shooting."
Charlie remembered this was procedure. There had been a false alarm once before. Like Ava Wilson, she was having a hard time believing that any of this was real. Lenore said,
"There's 2 sandwiches in a Tupperware bowl on your desk. I'll go to the phone store for you if you eat them."
"Deal," Charlie agreed. "Listen, I'm sorry about today. I'll try to be better."
Lenore rolled her eyes.
"Whatever."
Charlie waited until the door was closed to finish her whore's bath. She studied her face in the mirror as she cleaned herself. She was looking worse by the hour. There were 2 bruises, 1 under each eye, that made her look like a domestic violence victim. The bridge of her nose was dark red and had a bump on top of the other bump from the last time her nose had been broken. She told her reflection,
"You're going to stop being an idiot."
Her reflection looked as dubious as Lenore.
Charlie went back to her office. She dumped her purse on the floor to find her keys. Then she had to figure out how to shove everything back in. Then she realized that Lenore had already unlocked the door because Lenore was always 2 steps ahead of her. Charlie dropped her purse on the couch beside the door. She turned on the lights. Her desk, her computer. her chair. It felt good to be among familiar things. The office wasn't her home, but she spent more time here, especially since Ben had moved out, so it was the next best thing. She crammed down one of the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches Lenore had left on the desk. She skimmed her inbox on the computer and answered the emails asking if she was okay. Charlie should have listened to her voicemail, called her clients, and checked with the court to see when her hearings would be rescheduled, but she was too jittery to concentrate. Huck had all but admitted to taking the murder weapon from the scene. Why? Actually, the better question was, how? A revolver was not a small thing, and considering it was the murder weapon, the police would have been searching for it almost immediately. How did Huck sneak it out of the building? In his pants? Did he slip it into an unwitting paramedic's bag? Charlie supposed the Pikeville police had given Huck a wide berth. You didn't frisk an innocent civilian you'd accidentally shot. Huck had also erased the video that Charlie had taken, proving he was firmly on their side, inasmuch as Mr. Huckleberry believed in sides. But agents Delia Wolford and Louis Avery had no such loyalty to Mr. Huckabee. No wonder they had drilled him for 4 hours while the bullet wound in his arm slowly seeped. They probably suspected he'd taken the weapon, just like they suspected the local cops were idiots for letting him walk out the door without doing a thorough search. Lying to an FBI agent carried up to 5 years in federal prison and a $250,000 fine. Add on top of that the destruction of evidence, lying to hinder an investigation, and the possibility of Huck being charged as an accomplice after the fact to double homicide, and he would never work in a school, or probably anywhere else, ever again. All of which made things tricky for Charlie. Unless she wanted to destroy the man's life, she would need to find a way to tell her father about the gun without implicating Huck. She knew what Rusty would do if he smelt blood. Huck was the kind of handsome, clean-cut do-gooder that juries ate up with a spoon. His war record, his benevolent choice of profession, wouldn't matter if he testified from the stand in an orange prison jumpsuit. She looked at the clock over the couch. 2:16 p.m. This day was like a fucking never-ending sphere. Charlie opened a new Word document on her computer. She should type out everything she remembered and give it to Rusty. He had likely heard Kelly Wilson's story by now. Charlie could at least tell him what the prosecution had heard. Her hands hovered over the keyboard, but she didn't type. She watched the blinking cursor. She didn't know where to start. Obviously from the beginning, but the beginning was the hard part. Charlie's daily routine was normally set in granite. She got up at 5. She fed the various animals. She went for a run. She showered, she ate breakfast, she went to work, she went home. With Ben gone, her nights were filled with reading case files, watching mindless TV, and clock-watching for a non-demeaning time to go to bed. Today hadn't been like that, and Rusty would need to know the reason why. The least Charlie could do was find out Huck's first name. She opened the browser on her computer. She searched for Pikeville Middle School faculty. The little rainbow wheel started spinning. Eventually, the screen showed the message, "Website not responding." She tried to get around the landing page, typing in different departments, teachers' names, even the school newspaper. They all brought back the same message. The Pikeville Department of Education servers didn't have the capacity to handle hundreds of thousands of curiosity seekers trying to access their website. She clicked open a fresh search page. She typed, "Huckabee, Pikeville." "Crap," Charlie mumbled. Google had asked, "Do you mean Huckleberry?" The first site listed was a wiki entry saying that the huckleberry was the state fruit of Idaho. Then there were several stories about school boards trying to ban Huckleberry Finn. At the bottom of the page was an Urban Dictionary entry that claimed, "I'm your huckleberry," was 19th century slang for, "I'm your man." Charlie tapped her finger on the mouse. She should look at CNN or MSNBC or even Fox, but she couldn't bring herself to type in the news sites. An entire hour had passed without the slideshow coming back into her head. She didn't want to invite the flood of bad memories. Besides, this was Rusty's case. Charlie was likely going to be called as a witness for the prosecution. She would corroborate Huck's story, but that would only give the jury a small piece of the puzzle. If anyone knew more, it was Mrs. Pinkman. Her room was directly across from where Kelly had most likely stood when she began shooting. Judith Pinkman would have been first on the scene. She would have found her husband dead, Lucy dying. "Please, help us." Charlie could still hear the woman's screams echoing in her ears. The four shots had already been fired. Huck had dragged Charlie behind the filing cabinet. He was calling the police when she heard two more shots. Charlie was astonished by the sudden vividness of the memory. Six gunshots. Six bullets in the revolver. Otherwise, Judith Pinkman would have been shot in the face when she opened the door to her classroom. Charlie looked up at the ceiling. The thought had teased out an old image that she did not want to see. She had to get out of this office. She picked up the plastic bowl with a second PB&J and went to find Ava Wilson. Charlie knew that Lenore had already offered Ava food. She had that typically Southern impulse to feed everyone she met, just as Charlie was sure Ava was too stressed out to eat, but she didn't want the woman to be alone for too long. In the reception area, Charlie found a familiar scene. Ava Wilson on the couch in front of the television, the sound up too loud. She asked Ava, "Would you like my other sandwich?" Ava did not answer. Charlie was about to repeat the question when she realized that Ava's eyes were closed. Her lips were slightly parted, a soft whistle passing between a gap where one of her teeth was missing. Charlie didn't wake her. Stress had a way of shutting down your body when it couldn't take any more. If Ava Wilson had a moment's peace today, this would be it. The remote control was on the coffee table. Charlie never asked why it was always sticky. Most of the buttons didn't work. The others got stuck. The power button was unresponsive. The mute had evaporated. There was an open rectangle where the button had been. She went to the set to see if there was another way to turn it off. On screen, the news was in that lull period where there was no real information to report, so they'd brought on a panel of pundits and psychiatrists to speculate what might have happened, what Kelly possibly had been thinking, why she could have done the things that she did. "And there is precedent," a pretty blonde said. "If you remember the Boomtown Rats song from..." Charlie was about to yank the cord out of the wall when the main anchor interrupted the shrink. "We've got breaking news. I'll send you live to a press conference going on now in Pikeville, Georgia." The image changed again, this time to a podium set up in a familiar-looking space. The lunchroom at the police station. They had cleared the tables away and stuck a blue flag with the City of Pikeville logo on the wall. A chubby man wearing pleated tan Dockers and a white button-down shirt stood beside the podium. He looked to his left, and the camera panned to Ken Coyne, who seemed irritated when he waved for the man to go ahead. Coyne had clearly wanted to take the stage first. The man moved the microphone down, then up, then down again. He leaned over, his lips too close, and said, "I'm Rick Fahey. I'm Lucy Alex..." His voice caught. "Lucy Alexander's uncle." He used the back of his hand to wipe away tears. His face was red. His lips were too pink. "The family has asked me." "Oh." Fahey took a folded piece of notebook paper out of his back pocket. His hands were shaking so hard that the paper fluttered as if from a sudden wind. Finally, Fahey flattened the page down on the podium and said, "The family asked me to read this statement." Charlie looked back at Ava. She continued to sleep. Fahey read, "Lucy was a beautiful child. She was creative. She loved to sing and play with her dog, Shaggy. She was in Miss Dillard's Bible class at Mountain Baptist, where she loved reading the Gospels. She spent summers at her grandparents' farm down in Ellijay, where she helped them pick apples. He took a handkerchief out of his back pocket and patted the sweat and tears from his round face.
The family has put its trust in God to help us through this trying time. We ask for the thoughts and prayers of the community. Also, we would like to express our support for the Pikeville Police Department and the Dickerson County District Attorney's Office, Mr. Ken Coyne, to do everything they can to quickly bring justice to Lucy's
His voice caught again.
Murderer.
He looked up at the reporters.
That's what Kelly Wilson is. A cold-blooded murderer.
Fahey turned to Ken Coyne. The two exchanged a solemn nod of a promise that had likely been made. Fahey continued.
The family would like to ask in the meantime that the media and others respect our privacy. No funeral arrangements have been made yet.
His focus moved off into the distance, past the throng of microphones, past the cameras. Was he thinking about Lucy's funeral? How her parents would have to choose a child-sized casket to bury their daughter in? She had been so small. Charlie could remember how delicate the girl's hand had felt when she gripped it inside her own.
Mr. Fahey, one of the reporters asked, could you tell us? Thank you.
Fahey left the podium. Ken Coyne gave him a firm pat on the arm as they passed each other. Charlie watched her husband's boss grip the sides of the podium like he was about to sodomize it.
I'm Ken Coyne, the district attorney for the county, he told the crowd. I'm here to answer your questions about the prosecution of this vile murder. Make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, we will claim an eye for an eye in this egregious...
Charlie unplugged the television. She turned to make sure that Ava hadn't woken up. The woman was in the same position, still wearing her pajamas. The bag of clothes was on the floor at her feet. Charlie was trying to remember if they had a blanket somewhere when the back door banged open and slammed closed. Only Rusty entered the building making that much racket. Fortunately, the sounds had not awakened Ava. She only shifted on the couch, her head lolling to the side. Charlie left the sandwich on the coffee table before she went back to find her father.
Charlotte!
Rusty boomed. She heard his office door pop open. The knob had already dug a hole in the wall. He never passed up an opportunity to make noise.
Charlotte!
I'm here, Daddy.
She stopped outside the doorway. His office was so cluttered there was nowhere inside to stand. Ava Wilson's in reception.
Good girl.
He didn't look up from the papers in his hands. Rusty was a jittery half-tasker, never fully concentrating on one thing at a time. Even now, he was tapping his foot, reading, spontaneously humming, and carrying on something like a conversation.
How's she doing?
Not great. She dozed off a little while ago. Charlie talked to the top of his head. He was 74 years old, and his hair was still a thick salt and pepper that he kept too long on the sides. You need to go slow with her. I'm not sure how much she's following.
Noted.
He made a note on the papers. Rusty's bony fingers held a pen the same way he held a cigarette. Anyone who talked to him on the phone expected him to look like a cross between Colonel Sanders and Foghorn Leghorn. He was not. Rusty Quinn was a tall, rangy beanpole of a man, but not in the same way as Ben, because Charlie would have thrown herself off the mountain before she married someone like her father. Other than their height and an inability to throw out old underwear, the two men in her life were nothing alike. Ben was a dependable but sporty minivan. Rusty was an industrial-sized bulldozer. Despite two heart attacks and a double bypass, he gladly continued to indulge his vices. Bourbon, fried chicken, unfiltered camels, screaming arguments. Ben was drawn to thoughtful discussions, IPA, and artisanal cheeses. Actually, Charlie realized that there was a new similarity between the two. Today, both men were having a hard time looking at Charlie. She asked, what's she like?
The girl?
Rusty dashed off another note, humming as if the pen had some sort of rhythm.
Slip of a thing.
Coin must be shitting his pants. Jury's gonna fall in love with her.
Lucy Alexander's family might have something to say about that.
I am girded for battle.
Charlie stubbed her toe on the carpet. There was nothing he couldn't turn into a contest. You could try to do a deal with Ken, take the death penalty off the table.
Bah,
he answered, because they both knew Ken wouldn't deal.
I think we got a unicorn here.
Charlie's head snapped up. A unicorn was their word for an innocent client, a rare, mythical creature few had ever seen. She said, "You can't be serious."
"Course I'm serious. Why wouldn't I be serious?"
"I was there, Daddy." She wanted to shake him. "I was right in the middle of it."
"Ben caught me up to speed on what happened."
He coughed into the crook of his arm.
"Sounds like you had a real rough time of it."
That is a magnificent understatement.
"I am renowned for my subtlety."
Charlie watched him shuffle the papers. The humming resumed. She counted to 30 before he finally looked at her over his reading glasses. He was blissfully silent for almost another 10 seconds. Then a smile cracked open his mouth.
"Those are some real shiners, tough girl. You look like a bandito."
I was elbowed in the face.
"I already told Coin to get his checkbook at the ready."
I didn't file a complaint. He kept smiling.
"Good idea, baby. Hold your fire till this settles down. Never kick a fresh turd on a hot day."
Charlie put her hand to her eyes. She was too tired for the merry-go-round. "Dad, I need to tell you something." Her words went unanswered. She dropped her hand.
Rusty said, "This about why you were at the school this morning."
He had no problem looking at Charlie now. Their eyes locked for a very brief but uncomfortable moment before she looked away.
He said, "So now you know I know."
"Did Ben tell you?" He shook his head.
"Old Kenny Coin had the pleasure."
Charlie wasn't going to apologize to her father. "I'll write down everything I can remember from today. What I told the GBI agent who took my statement. She's an SAC, Delia Wolford. I've got her card. She interviewed the other witness along with an agent named Avery or Atkins. Ben was in the room with me. I think Coin was behind the mirror, or in the other room most of the time." Rusty made sure she was finished before saying,
"Charlotte, I am assuming if you were not okay, you would tell me."
"Russell, I am assuming that you are smart enough to extrapolate that information from the raw data."
"Hello, familiar impasse."
He dropped the papers on his desk.
"The last time I tried to guess your mood, a first-class stamp was 29 cents, and you stopped talking to me for 16¾ days.
Charlie had long lost the will to negotiate his sympathy. "I heard there's a hole in the school security footage."
"Where'd you get that?"
"The Gettin' place."
"Pick up anything else while you were there?"
"They're worried about the murder weapon. Like, maybe they don't know exactly where it ended up." His eyebrows jumped.
"Well, that's a pickle."
"That's a guess," Charlie said, not wanting to throw scent onto Huck. "The GBI agent was asking me a lot of questions about where it was. When did I see it last? Who had it? When? What? Where? Revolver. I'm not 100%, but I think it was a 6-shot. Rusty's eyes narrowed.
"There's something else, right? If I am allowed the extrapolation?"
Charlie turned around, knowing he would follow. She was halfway across the building when she heard his heavy footsteps behind her. He had a long, quick stride because he thought walking fast passed for cardio. She heard his fingers tap the wall. He hummed what sounded like "Happy Birthday." The only time Charlie ever saw her father completely still was inside a courtroom. Charlie found her bag on the couch in her office. She pulled out the yearbook. Rusty came to a breathless standstill.
"What's that?"
"It's a yearbook. Sometimes it's called an annual." He crossed his arms over his chest.
You need to be more specific with your old pappy.
You buy it at school at the end of the year. It has class pictures and club photos, and people write things in the pages, like, I'll never forget you, or thanks for helping me in biology. She shrugged. It's a stupid thing. The more signatures you get, the more popular you are.
That explains why you never brought one home.
Ha ha. He asked,
so, was our gal popular, not popular?
I didn't open it. Charlie waved the book in Rusty's face, indicating he should take it. He kept his arms crossed, but she saw that switch flick inside him, the same one that came on inside the courtroom. He asked,
where was this found?
In Kelly Wilson's closet in her home.
Before the execution of the search warrant?
Yes.
Did anyone from law enforcement tell you there was going to be a search warrant filed?
No.
Did the mother,
Ava Wilson?
Did Ava Wilson give this to you to hold on to?
No.
Is she your client?
No, and thanks for trying to help me lose my license.
You'd have the best attorney in the country making sure you kept it.
Rusty nodded toward the yearbook.
Open it for me.
Take it or I'll drop it on the floor.
God damn, you make me miss your mama.
Rusty's voice had a funny quiver. He rarely mentioned Gamma, and if he did, it was only to make a not always favorable comparison to Charlie. He took the yearbook and gave her a salute.
Many thanks.
She watched his exaggerated march up the hallway. Charlie called, hey, asshole! Rusty turned around, grinning as he marched back the same way he'd left. He opened the yearbook with a flourish. The inside flap was filled with written messages, some in black ink, some in blue, a few in pink. Different handwriting, different signatures. Rusty turned the page. More ink colors. More hastily scratched missives. If Kelly Wilson was a loner, she was the most popular loner at school.
Rusty said, excuse me, miss. I'm not stepping on your scruples here if I ask you to read me some of this.
He tapped his temple.
Don't have my spectacles.
Charlie indicated that he should turn the book around. She read the first line that jumped out at her, a blocky print that looked like it belonged to a boy. Hey, girl, thanks for the awesome head. You suck. She looked up at her father.
Whoa. Whoa, indeed.
Rusty was unshockable. Charlie had given up trying years ago.
Continue.
Gonna rape you, bitch. No signature. She skimmed around. Another rape threat. Gonna do some sodomy on your ass, bitch. Sodomy spelled with an I.
At the end or in the middle?
End. She searched for some pink cursive, hoping the girls proved to be a lesser evil. You are a fucking whore and I hate you and I want you to die. 6 exclamation points, K-I-T, Mindy Zawada.
K-I-T?
Rusty asked. Keep in touch.
Heartfelt.
Charlie scanned the other notes, which were equally as lewd as the first. They're all like that, Dad. Either calling her a whore or referring to sex or asking for sex or saying they're going to rape her. He turned to the next page, which had been left blank so that classmates could write more notes. There were no notes. A giant cock and balls took up most of the space. At the top was a drawing of a girl with stringy hair and wide eyes. Her mouth was open. There was an arrow pointed at her head with the word Kelly. Rusty said,
a picture slowly starts to emerge.
Keep going. He turned more pages, more drawings, more lewd messages, some rape threats. Kelly's class picture had been defiled. This time the cock and balls pointing at her mouth was ejaculating. Charlie said, they must have passed this around the school. Hundreds of kids were in on it.
She was how old, do you think, when this was done?
12 or 13.
And she kept it all this time.
He drew out the word as if he was testing how it would sound in front of a jury. Charlie couldn't fault him the performance. He was holding in his hands a textbook example of a mitigating factor. Kelly Wilson had not only been bullied at school. The sexual aggression in the messages from her classmates pointed to something even darker. Rusty asked, "Did the mother say the girl was sexually assaulted?" "The mother thinks the girl is a snowflake."
"All right,"
Rusty said.
"So if something happened, then it might be in her school records, or there might be somebody you could ask at the DA's office who..."
"No," Charlie knew to shut him down quickly. "You can ask Ava to request a copy of her school records, and you can do a juvenile court query on a possible file."
"I will do exactly that,"
Charlie said. "You need a really good computer guy, someone who can do forensic searches into social media accounts. If enough kids were involved in this yearbook project, there might even be a separate Facebook page for it."
"I don't need a guy. I've got CNN.
He was right. The media would already have experts scouring the web. Their reporters would be talking to Kelly's classmates, her teachers, looking for friends or people who claim to be friends who were willing to go on camera and say anything, true or not, about Kelly Wilson. Charlie asked, "Did you get a chance to check on Mrs. Pinkman?"
"I tried to pay a social visit, but she was heavily sedated."
He exhaled a raspy breath.
"Bad enough to lose a partner, but to lose him like that is the very definition of anguish."
Charlie studied him, trying to figure out his tone. Twice now he had mentioned Gamma. She supposed that was her fault, considering her involvement this morning at the school. Another arrow she had slung her father's way. "Where did you go today after the hospital?"
"Took a little side trip down to Kennesaw to do a satellite interview. You'll be treated to your daddy's handsome visage all over your TV tonight."
Charlie wasn't going to be near a TV if she could help it. "You're going to have to be careful with Ava, Daddy. She doesn't understand a lot. I don't think it's just shock. She doesn't track."
"Daughter has the same problem. I'd put her IQ in the low 70s.
He tapped the yearbook.
"Thanks for the help, my dear. Did Ben get in touch with you this morning?"
Her heart flipped the same way it had when she'd first heard that Ben had called. "No. Do you know why he was calling me?"
"I do."
Her desk phone rang. Rusty started to leave. "Dad?"
"You will need your umbrella tomorrow. 63% chance of rain in the AM.
He hummed a passable happy birthday, giving her a salute as he backed down the hall, knees high like a marching band leader. She said, "You're going to give yourself another heart attack."
"You wish."
Charlie rolled her eyes. He always had to make a fucking exit. She picked up the phone. "Charlie Quinn?" "I'm not supposed to be talking to you," Terry, the youngest of Ben's older sisters, said. "But I wanted to make sure you were all right." "I'm good." Charlie could hear Terry's twins screaming in the background. Ben called them Denise and DeNephew. She told Terry, "Ben said he called you guys this morning. He was pretty upset."
"Upset at me or about me?"
"Well, you know, that's been a damn 9-month-long mystery." It wasn't, actually, but Charlie knew anything she told Terry would be passed on to Carla and Peggy, who would tell Ben's mother, so she kept her mouth firmly shut. Terry asked, "You there?"
"Sorry, I'm at work."
Terry didn't take the hint. "I was thinking when Ben called about how funny he is about talking about things. You have to poke and poke and poke, and then maybe, eventually, he'll tell you back in 1998 you stole a French fry off his plate and it really hurt his feelings." She said more, but Charlie tuned her out, listening instead to Terry's children try to kill each other. Charlie had been sucked in by Ben's bitchy sisters once before, taking them at face value when she should have realized there was a reason Ben only saw them at Thanksgiving. They were bossy, unthinking women who tried to rule Ben with an iron fist. He was in college before he realized that men were allowed to be standing up. Terry said, "And then I was talking to Carla about this thing going on with you two. Doesn't make any sense at all. You know he loves you, but he's got something up his butt and he won't say anything." She stopped a moment to yell at her children, then picked up the conversation where she'd left off. Has Benny said anything to you yet? Given you any kind of reason?
No, Charlie lied, thinking if they knew Benny.